Hi, everybody. I'm Scott.
Hello, I'm Julie.
And this is A Good Story is Hard to Find podcast,
where two Catholic friends talk about the books and movies they love and the traces of the one reality that lie below the surface.
All right. And it's a new year. And you know what that means, Julie. We have a special guest with us this time.
Yeah.
We have a special guest that usually our first episode of every year we try to bring someone in. And we're thrilled to have with us Father Stephen. He is a Cistercian monk and a professor at the University of Dallas. Hello, Father Stephen.
Hello, y'all.
Thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Yeah. So talk quickly about Cistercian, please.
Yeah, Cistercian, we're a monastery here in Irving, right west of Dallas. And we're a monastic order that's been around for, we're coming close to 1,000 years, about the year 1100 we were founded, and kind of a form of Benedictine life that we lead. So it's a contemplative life, but then we also, in kind of the branch that we belong in, do work in education as well. So we have our monastery here. There's about 35 of us right now. The oldest is close to 95. The youngest, I think, is maybe 22. and so a wide variety of people. And we have a school that we own and operate here, kind of next door to the monastery, for boys grades 5 through 12. And then several of us work at the University of Dallas across the street.
Well, that's wonderful. I'm so thrilled when you say that there's a 22-year-old there. That just makes me happy.
Yeah, well, even more, we have seven guys this year who are new.
Wonderful.
So novices. They're not all that young, but three of them are below the age of 25. It's striking.
That makes me so happy. Well, wonderful. So this is episode number 347, and we've asked you to bring a book, and the book you've chosen is The Betrothed by Alessandro Manzoni. Did I say that right?
No.
Even with a little bit of an Italian tilt to it?
Yes.
What draws you to this book, and why did you bring it to us?
Well, it's a book that I try to get lots of people to read. And since you volunteered for my attack, I just threw it at you. But it's one of those books that's not as well known as maybe it should be. Even in the Catholic world, where it's more well-known anyway, it's a deeply Catholic novel in many ways. I didn't encounter it till I was living in Italy. I lived in Italy for 3 years as a monk doing studies in theology in Rome. And when I would be asking the Italians there, you know, what should I read to try? Like, I'd already read Dante, you know, and that's a much more difficult older Italian. So I thought, well, what should I read to really understand Italian better? Because new novels are often very difficult to read in Italian for me, because I mostly know theology in Italian. I don't know the street language very well. So I thought, I want something older. Like, if I could find Charles Dickens in Italian, you know?
Yes.
And they said, oh, well, obviously you have to read Manzoni. This is the novel that every Italian high schooler is forced to read, often quite painful memories associated with it. And so it came on my radar there. And there's certain characters in it that are come up in random points in conversation in Italy. And so I thought, well, it's sort of like how Shakespeare shows up in our language all over the place. So I became fascinated by it. And then once I was working at the university, and even really at our school, and thinking about, you know, what are the books I really think people should read to form their worldview and to understand how novels can help with that, I'm always looking for something new. And this is one that I've been eager to try to test out on people. It's, of course, immensely long, which is a disadvantage nowadays, generally. But that's, I guess, why I proposed it. I thought of a few other things, but I've been wanting to make myself think about it more fully, and find some people who I knew would read and to discuss it. And I just, sitting at lunch yesterday, one of the other monks I happened to sit next to, I found out he was reading it during Christmas, and I didn't even know. So,
that's great.
It's also been it kind of has appeared on the radar because there's this new translation came out just 2 years ago or 3 years ago.
Yeah. Do you think that the translation, the previous translations were an impediment to English reading?
Yeah, they tended to be more kind of stilted translation-ese, you know? Mm-hmm. Which is interesting because the very opening of the novel is about trying to not write that way, you know, the found book that's in a old style. But they weren't so bad, but somehow it felt inauthentic, you know? Mm-hmm. The same was sort of true, they say, of like, so a lot of Kafka's works are being retranslated because the great work of the Muirs, the couple who translated them 100 years ago, they were good, they were pioneering, but it's a very kind of artsy form of language, and it loses much of the humor. So I do think this is, there are a lot of points where I said, I've got to see what this is in Italian, because I've got the Italian edition too. And I found it always pretty good.
Okay. Because I heard of this when the new translation came out. Suddenly, Catholic podcasters or bloggers or whatever I was looking at were like, and The Betrothed. I'm like, what? But it was always because of the new translation. It made it so much more lively. And I found that when our book club read Kristen Lovren's Daughter.
Yeah.
Which had a newer translation, which was much more approachable. And this, you can see, is a very conversational way of speaking a lot of the time.
Yeah.
But I had planned to read it this year because the Close Reads podcast on their subscriber channel, they're going to talk about it, and they'll talk about it in probably 50-page or 100-page pieces.
Mm. Yeah.
So it will be closer. But I was excited when you did this because I was like, this is going to shove me into reading it just on my own.
Yeah, it has really been appearing in a lot of places. I think also there's a kind of all of our recent memories of the pandemic somehow enter into our reading of certain sections of the novel.
Yeah, I did. Yeah.
that was some powerful chapters there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. But in fact, because this is mentioned all over the place, the plague is prominent in some parts of this book. But they get to a part toward the end where somebody's traveling around again. And they said, oh, the plague wasn't like it had been. People would get sick and complain, but nobody took it that seriously. And nobody was dying anymore, even going to the hospital. I went, oh, my gosh, it's just like COVID.
It is strange. It's almost surreal to read it, parts of it. Even in this translation, there's that phrase, out of an abundance of caution. And I thought, wow, you know, it's interesting because it really is the Italian, it's abbondare di cautela. It's like the same expression. I realized what it must have been like in Italy during COVID.
Oh my gosh.
Everyone had read this book already, you know?
We're living the book again.
But I think, I found it even in that, I think that's one of the ways that it's sort of moved into a broader interest among readers who are not in any way Catholic. It's had a strong following in the church, just especially in Italy. One of the ways I introduced it, I probably even told Julie this when I first was talking about it, is that it's a novel that is recommended by both Pius X and Pope Francis. And these are two men who don't tend to recommend the same thing, you know? Although Pius X himself also came from a rural background. So, I mean, he knows the country parish life, but I thought that's a good sign.
That is a good sign.
Yeah, it's hitting everything.
Yeah. Yeah.
How wonderful. So let's summarize it, if you would, kind of in a non-spoiler way for folks who want to read it before we delve.
Yeah, it's in some way it's an easy book to summarize, I guess, right? I mean, it's called The Betrothed. In Italian, it's I Promessi Sposi, so the promised spouses, right? That's their way of saying that. And it starts with a very beginning. You've got a couple who are engaged. In fact, it's really the day before their wedding is when the action really starts. And the local lord, Don Rodrigo, doesn't want the wedding to go through. He has his eyes on Lucia, the bride-to-be. And the first scene we get is the kind of mafia-style intimidation of the rather bumbling parish priest, Don Abbondio. And all the rest of the action sort of flows from this frustrated moment, right? And there's kind of a blow up in the home little rural town. We're in the north of Italy, kind of near the big lakes up in the north of Italy. Lake Como is where they're near. And the two young people end up having to basically flee the town because of the dangerous sort of mafia boss that runs the place. At which point we're then on a rather complicated, hard to outline journey. The young man ends up going to the big city, to Milan, and which is in a state of disastrous uproar for a whole variety of reasons throughout that latter part of the novel. So famine and plague and war. He ends up having to cross out of the territory again to Bergamo. So there's much of the middle of the novel. We have the two lovers are separated, both suffering various kinds of challenges, emotional and practical and financial and spiritual, with a whole cast of characters around them who are sometimes their hosts where they're staying. So the convent that for a while Lucia is sort of hiding in. And we watch as the tale of these two really the lowest kind of protagonists, right? Two poor people, not absolutely poor, but rather poor. He is a silk worker. How they get swept up in huge movements, political and sort of cataclysmic movements that then bring about the conclusion. And along the way, we get a whole variety of other interesting characters. So it's brilliant. There's the, or rather, absolutely not brilliant parish priest. There's the kind of heroic Capuchin friar, Fra Cristoforo. There's the saintly Cardinal Federico Borromeo, the nephew of, you know, St. Charles Borromeo. And there's the kind of the incompetent scholar. There's the nefarious lawyer. There's the mafioso. There's the they call them the bravi, right? These sort of tough dudes. And there's soldiers. There's faithful friends. There's the scary nun.
At one point, and I'm trying to remember if this is the right book to reference. My daughter Rose had read Clarissa.
Yeah.
And that's a super duper old gothic novel that I think the evil lord is in love with this beautiful young woman. He's doing everything he can to try to get her to marry him.
Yeah.
While he's busy ravaging every other young lady in sight.
Yeah. Yeah. But it is. That's one of the, I think of all the parts of the plot, that's the most generic, you know. Appropriate to the genre that he's
from
working.
Don Rodrigo. Yeah, but because all the things he was going through at the beginning and the friends he was calling in and the things that were happening and the mother and then Perpetua, the priest, housekeeper and that stuff, I was like talking to Rose about this going, this stuff all just feels like it's taken out of either a classic novel like that or a play.
Yeah.
Not a novel that's like you say, it's not like Shakespeare.
Yeah.
You can revere it. It's more like you cross an old novel with P.G. Woodhouse sometimes.
That's a great way to put that. Yeah.
Yeah, it is interesting. I think in English, what it most reminds me of is probably Tom Jones.
Oh, I haven't read
although
that,
also, yeah. Which is, I would recommend, although it's long and strange, which is really an 18th century thing. That's not really a gothic novel. That's the sort of the way that the narrator intrudes kind of humorously and kind of the P.G. Wodehouse quality sometimes of the story. But on top of that, you've then got this kind of Dickensian flair, but we're not in the city as much. And then but the world it comes out of is of the Gothic novel. I mean, the first edition came out in 1827. Jane Austen hasn't hit Italy yet, you know.
So, that's before Dickens. So
yeah, exactly. So it's more like Anne Radcliffe and things like that that we're reading, and the Casper Otranto. So it's an interesting choice of form. Like, the novel in Italy wasn't really a big thing yet, but it's also weird. Like, he probably chooses it in his mind. The model is maybe Ivanhoe. Which he read in French. Yes. If you can imagine, he read the French translation of Ivanhoe. Manzoni lived in Paris for a lot of his youth. He has actually a rather complicated youth and biography. And the weird thing is, though, that, I mean, he chose a novel, which is kind of unusual for an Italian writing anyway, but then he sets it in the 1600s, mm-hmm. whereas the Romantic novels usually were set in the Middle Ages, you know?
Certainly Ivanhoe.
Yeah, certainly Ivanhoe, at least, right? And so it's a kind of an odd. I mean, the Italians find the book important because this is sort of the novel that creates Italy as a literary, like, even linguistically, actually. This is really an important work of linguistic creation for Italians, but kind of the image of who they are as a modern people. Is in this novel. It's interesting that all of its choices are kind of unusual.
And in that sense, that kind of actually helps me. So here's the thing. I was reading this book, and Scott knows how I feel about this kind of writing. You go, oh, I probably should tell you about our good Fra Cristoforo or whatever. And I go, he was born here, and then here's his life story. And I'm just like, am I really going to have, is this all going to be relevant later? Because it's a whole chapter. And I'm reading it, going, no, it's not relevant. Right. To my modern mind, it is zero relevance.
Yeah. No, and for people who read a lot of novels now. I mean, our model is much more kind of Flaubert and Henry James, and there's a sort of tightness to the structure.
Straightforwardness, right. What I was going to say is, you know, because he does this with the nun story, which I read with great attention, thinking we're going to get a lot more about this nun. Nope. Hello, come and let me teach you how to spin, Lucia. You make me feel like I should be a better person.
It's strange. Anyway. And I think it's so that the two characters that I heard about before, actually three characters I heard about before I ever read the novel. Of course, the nun of Monza. In Italian, it's La Monaca di Monza. And she's a famous character. And it confused me. I mean, she's effectively in two chapters. Mm-hmm. And then she has a moment later. But her story is there. And I was sure that she was a central figure.
It's a
captivating portrait.
That's the thing. So I'm reading it, and after the second time he does this, which is, I think, maybe Don Rodrigo, I'm like, oh, wait, hold on. And then we get to Milan, and we're getting the story of wheat and bread, and I guess we might be into spoilers some now. But the thing is that I was going, oh, I know this. This is like Les Miserables, which I really do like that book, but there are parts where you're just like, Waterloo, really? And then because he's making a point that's not always clear to me as a first time reader anyway, and or non-Italian, or War and Peace. That happens all the time. Well, let me tell you about these battles up close and personal. And you're just like, the main characters were in it like twice. And so what he adopted was this really, to me, specific way of telling this story where he was weaving in things where I could see why it was so important to the Italians.
Yeah.
Because they were being filled in on their own history of the.
Yeah, you got to remember at this time, I mean, when he was writing, Italy still wasn't a united country. So it's in the aftermath of the Napoleonic Wars. So it's not till 1870 that Rome capitulated, the Papal States capitulated, and Italy was really united as we know it. And that's 50 years, basically, after this writing was begun. The truth is that This is a long, and Henry James called these novels loose, baggy monsters, right? it's like that, but it's actually much compressed. In the original, he was writing, in the original version, the male protagonist, who's we now call Renzo, which is Lorenzo, he was called Fermo, which means like steady, right? Mm. Sort of a allegorical name almost. But like the nun of Monza was like a third of the novel. It was, he wrote a huge amount about her, and he whittled it down to just what we've got here.
God bless him.
Yeah. And he, and believe it or not, included even more about the plague and the famine and the kind of chronicle, historical chronicles was even larger. And he actually wrote this novel twice. Well, really three times. There was an original kind of idea, which he then scrapped. There is then a version in 1827, which was written in kind of polished literary language, which is more or less the novel the content of the novel plot-wise is more or less what we have now. He then went to live in Florence for a few years to learn real Italian. And he rewrote the entire novel, every single word of it, for 1840, which is, that's the one we're really reading a translation of, where he tried to create real popular language rather than elevated Lombardic kind of idiom that he had used. So it's kind of a debate in it when you're thinking sort of at a literary level, is this novel overflowing, or is it actually very restrained? I mean, it's very long, but it could still have a certain restraint to it. And it's sort of, I don't know. You could look at it. I look at it either way, depending on which day I'm reading it, I think.
Well, and what I was going to say is, for me, since I've read novels like this before anyway, I mean, in terms of the digression, I could understand that he had his purpose and it had a purpose. I wasn't always catching it, so I knew the problem was not necessarily with the novel. But I also am famous, as Scott will know, for going, I've read about the plague in a lot of other places. Where's our main character? I'll skim, skim, skim. Here we go. But at the same time, I would have hated for him to cut anything about Federigo Borromeo. Mm. I loved that. And the Nameless One.
Mm. Yeah.
You know, all those pieces, which would seem long and maybe pointless to some people, I found those to be the heart of the novel. And in some senses, not in the writing style, but it made me think, because I'd heard how formational it was to Italy in that way, the people and the way they think of themselves. It made me think of Gone with the Wind.
Oh, yeah. Huh.
Where cultural moment. We're defining it for ourselves in this way. And Scott, you and I talked about that in two parts a few years ago,
yeah,
I guess.
We did, yeah.
And how it was the point of view from the people who lost in a big conflict like this, and how do they go on? And there is a lot more to it, of course, but it has set for America how you think of the Confederacy and the aftermath with Reconstruction and everything. And you'll find people now railing against it for one reason or another, maybe valid, maybe not, but it doesn't matter. Gone with the Wind is a part of our mental landscape as Americans. And that's when I could really appreciate what he was doing with looking at the city of Milan. And now here comes the war. And now here's everyone in the Lazaretto. And if that's how you say it, and all those things. So I was really kind of glad to get this chance to read it and think about it in terms of what was done for people, whether he meant that or not, you know, whether he was just writing the best book he knew how to write, which is why I did it three times. He was doing something else.
Yeah, there is some kind of intentional, it's sort of like what we would call world building, but of a very strange kind, right?
Yeah.
But it's, I think what the challenge he's facing, or he's chosen it, I mean, is it's a chaotic world. 17th century Italy is ruled by all the parts of it are ruled by different people. And Milan is ruled by the Spaniards, and it's an era of notorious chaos culturally. And I mean, a part of the fun of it, but also the parts that tend to flow too much. It's like the list of titles that get attached to a decree, but the decree is completely ineffective, you know? and the sort of lamentation, which again feels very Italian. I mean, they have an operating government now, more or less, but the sort of lamentation that there's a lot of formality in politics, but no real effect. And
yeah,
and instead you have like, and so he's trying to give you, there's no way to do that without doing too much of it somehow.
Right.
And then it makes those moments of real human virtue and beauty somehow shine more clearly, maybe. Mm-hmm. It's a tough thing to.
Yeah. And there were those moments of extreme beauty, I felt. So, you know, what I know about Italy, I learned from The Godfather, you know, the parts that were set in Italy. So I'm wondering, you know, did he choose to call that person the unnamed, this mafia kind of boss? Because if it had been connected, even if it was unintentional, to a family or something, that would have been an uncomfortable thing. I'm just wondering why he did that.
Yeah, it's, I think that is... So a lot of the characters like him are based in reality to some degree.
Yeah. Yeah. I noticed that there was some like Bergamo or Brimo. Right.
Yeah.
The
nun of Monza is based on a real person.
That's cool. Yeah.
And the unnamed
was also based on someone, because wasn't he called by that villain's or, you know, criminal's name in the book?
I think
that's first, right. Like an earlier edition.
Yeah. The unnamed, I do think he's mainly choosing it because it's such a cool thing to call the guy.
Okay.
Cool.
You know, that's fair enough. I was wondering.
The nameless one. But the novel presents it as, you know, I don't dare say the name because I don't want to make a bad impression. But if you think about it, like Voldemort, yeah. Or even Mordor and Sauron. It happens in Lord of the Rings where it's don't say that name. Mm-hmm. Of course, you got to remember, I mean, he's writing 200 years after the events of the novel. He's writing in the 1830s, let's say, and he's writing about the 1630s.
Sure.
So if that's why Federico Borromeo is already, who's a real person, right? I mean, mm-hmm. He is already dead. So he can bestow praise on that person. I do think he is creating that kind of mafia in feeling and environment. Maybe the first to really create it, you know, by using the unnamed, l'innominato, the one who is not named, in Italian. And every time someone says his name, we don't get the name, but people occasionally say the real name. Everyone reacts with terror, you know, which is kind of true of Rodrigo as well. But,
He's more of this, when you mention the mafia, that really kind of put them into a sharper focus for me, because that is something that we understand from American movies and stuff, if nothing else. And somewhere in the shadows on top of this mountain, there's this guy who we won't say his name, but he'll do everything.
I love the crazy castle. Yeah.
Mm. Yeah.
And I mean, the turning of the nameless one, I mean, that's, that's one of those passages and moments that I heard about frequently. It came up in homilies in Italy, right? It's one of those fascinating moves, so that this dark and terrifying castle is later on the refuge for people when the German soldiers are basically marching. They're called Germans, whatever they are exactly, are marching over the territory. And that's considered kind of one of those master strokes, you know. Mm-hmm. And, but it does feel to me like I just watched The Godfather for the first time in my life just a few months ago. I don't know how I avoided it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I knew all the scenes already. It really did feel like, and we feel like that, you know, we don't want to say, well, that's the Italian character. I mean, it's basically a bunch of criminals, but there's something about the experience of Italy now that has that. I mean, it's a country that for a few centuries was very, on the one hand, largely lawless, on the other hand, deeply religious. And so very conflicted, the poor and the rich, And then to take that, of course, The Godfather's about that. When that becomes an immigrant experience, you add a certain pressure to it, right?
Right, right.
It's really Southern Italy that we're thinking about in the Godfather.
Mm-hmm. There were parts in The Godfather 1 and 2 that took place in Italy.
Oh, yeah.
From chapter 1, there was a familiarity to it, because you got the Brasi threatening the priest in chapter 1. And him, seeing them there and going, boy, I don't really want to go over there, but how do I not go over there right now? So he,
such a coward. Such
yeah,
an annoying.
Yeah, very. But it was familiar territory. And,
certainly
not really saying famous... that Italians are all criminals or anything. I'm not saying that at all. But the structure of there's some powerful boss in town that seems to be running things and thinks he can have whatever he wants is familiar territory.
Like in the vacuum of authority.
Right, right. Right. Yeah.
It's a famous opening moment. The original Italian edition has these great little kind of pencil illustrations. But as Don Abbondio is turning the corner, he sees the two Bravi.
Yes.
And they're dressed just like you expect them to be. But there's right behind or around in that same site. And in the illustration, it's between the two guys. Is this roadside shrine of like souls burning in purgatory.
Oh.
So you kind of get this, it opens with this like purgatory or in purgatory, right? It's this disastrous, painful world of experience, but we're supposed to have hope that it's going to lead us to what's best, right?
Yeah.
And he puts that at the, even Don Abbondio, who is such an idiot, and a frustrating character to read, even he somehow is going to come through that purgatorial journey. Even the Bravi in their own way, at the end, a lot of them, go their own way, but then some kind of remain and are changed. It's a very like politically real experience, but then you see right away, he includes a sort of spiritual vision from the beginning.
Hmm.
Yeah, and I thought I really had high hopes for Don Abbondio because, you have such clear juxtapositions so much of the time. You have Federigo Borromeo, you have the Nameless One, you have, the very great saint and the very great evil, what happens when they encounter each other, and Lucia, who's kind of a spark for a lot of people because she's truly innocent and pure and trying to do God's will. But you have all these contrasts and he's in the middle. He's this lukewarm coward who's self-serving, but not in a way that's grasping necessarily. It's just his character. He doesn't want conflict. He just kind of shies away from it. He just wants everyone to be kind of nice and leave him alone. And in general. And so, one of my favorite parts of the book, I was laughing so hard when he's facing Federigo Borromeo, who's telling him the most wonderful reasons and being so realistic and never quits. And I was like, wow, you are a saint. This is great. And the whole time he's sitting there going, oh gosh, why does he keep saying this stuff to me? Can't he tell? What am I going to say now? And he wouldn't talk a lot. And so Don Abbondio I'm talking about. So
yeah.
I kept thinking there was this one moment during that when he said he suddenly thought of the other suffering people in a way he never had. He could have some compassion. He could see how his actions hurt them. And I'm like, oh, maybe this is it. So I was really expecting, because the book kind of begins and ends with him, that we were going to see, here's the big change. And instead what we saw was nothing was any different for this guy.
Yeah.
So I kind of really liked the fact that we see people going on their arc. Some people don't change. The mother never changes.
Yeah.
That kind of thing. Because they're already kind of set in who they are. Lucia doesn't really change. She has to learn and grow some.
Mm.
Father or Padre Cristoforo, he's already on his way to becoming a saint. And which is, I guess, why they showed us all the beginning part.
Yeah,
he'd been through that before.
Yeah, Cristoforo, he's really a contrast to
Abbondio. Yeah,
Abbondio.
Yeah,
it is one of the things I definitely think when I read it is I am expecting Don Abbondio to kind of become heroic.
Yeah,
but he at the end, I mean, he's sort of comic maybe, which is an improvement. he's tragically cowardly at the beginning.
Yeah.
And really, in many ways, his lack of charity is the cause of the entire problem,
which was pointed out to him
very clearly. But then at the end, when they come a second time to ask to be married, he still resists. But it's somehow, once he finds out that the enemy is gone, he's sort of jolly, and you see it's like he's so deeply selfish, but almost in a way that you don't condemn. It's sort of like you're always at the center of your own map, you know. He's not a magnanimous person, right? he's a man with a very small soul.
Yeah.
And that's as much as he can be converted. I mean, to me, what I love about the novel, the way I've been thinking about it this last, month, I've been kind of rereading it, is it really is about a series of conversions and possible conversions. One of the most famous passages is, it's a particular virtue of the Christian religion that anyone who follows it, no matter, it always shows you a way to go, either to fix what can be fixed or to move on from what can't be changed. And this is about the nun of Monza. And it's this beautiful passage about there's always a possibility of change.
Yeah.
And we see it with the nameless one. But then the immediate thing that happens is, he says, the nun of Monza thus could have become a good nun, but she doesn't, right?
Yeah.
So like you can't.
I feel like that, for her, it was left ambiguous. I guess we really don't know.
Yeah, we don't
she
really
see. She's sent to jail, doesn't she? Doesn't Lucia get told she was imprisoned?
It might be we hear that
she gets caught. She really did all these bad things. Like somebody you could trust told her that.
Yeah.
And Lucia was sorry for her and was praying for her. I was surprised at that point.
Yeah.
And you're right, that we aren't shown she might change some. But I kind of think of, I don't think Don Abbondio actually, he's only jolly and more humorous because he's not asked to stand up for anything still.
Yeah.
He is still the same exact person, I think. So I think he's contrasted at the end with Renzo, who's still essentially the same person. The only thing that's different is because of his experience in the Lazaretto and other things too, but that's the main one, where he's looking at Don Rodrigo and being forced to really see how similar he and Don Rodrigo are in their lack of forgiveness and their desire for vengeance by Padre Cristoforo. Mm-hmm. And he doesn't even take that consciously to the end, but at the end he realizes, by being in a new village, he says, oh my gosh, the way I was in the old village was wrong. I was too judgmental. I would say things about people. I wouldn't forgive them, all this stuff. And he goes, I do need to live a different way. And I think, to me, he's got a small soul in that way. That's the most he can do. And maybe it's the most he needs to do.
Yeah.
We can't all be great saints. But Don Abbondio doesn't do that. He can't even, at the end of all this stuff, go, I will marry you.
Yeah.
He's had a specific homily. He's had all the things on it. He's not even willing to stop and think like Renzo is and go, well, in this one instance, this is right.
It is. Yeah, it is.
So I like the way the author is continually pointing out these little contrasts to us if we're thinking about where they are in the book,
I do love that it's one of those stories that's told extremely briefly, right? At the very end of Renzo, kind of realizing, because he's living there and the townspeople basically don't think Lucia is very beautiful.
I know.
And so he realizes that poisons his entire framework of experiencing that village becomes more and more bitter. And of course, it seems like it's their fault, which is
right.
Don Abbondio. It's always not fair to make him do something. It's your fault.
Yeah. Right?
And I know a lot of people like this.
Mm-hmm. Oh, sure.
Not to slide into it. It's a big temptation. Yeah.
And then when we get this, it's like a page where we hear that Renzo realizes this. They move to a new place and start afresh. So you see, it's obviously in many ways a very happy ending with money flowing in from different places on top of everybody. And, but there's still this need for, we need to still grow, you know? It'd be interesting to think about how Cristoforo, who's, his sort of conversion is fascinating, that, I mean, he's kind of murdered someone sort of in self-defense, sort of not, becomes a friar as a way of penance or whatever. And, but he still has his same kind of active heroic temperament, but it's now sort of changed over by this other part of him. And to watch him in the Lazaretto and his, I mean, it, mm-hmm. His last, there's a few points in the novel where there's these kind of obvious kind of proverbial teachings, you know, and he mm. gives that one of the great images, that the bread of forgiveness, right? Mm. The, I guess it's the brother maybe of the man he killed gave him
bread, mm-hmm.
and he kept
that's what he carries around with him.
Kept in his pocket. Stale
piece of bread in a little carved box, and he gives it to Renzo, I guess, or and Lucia. Mm-hmm. He says, and I wrote this one quote down. He says, "Show it to your children. They will grow up in a sad world and in sad times, surrounded by the proud and the irate. Tell them they must always forgive and forgive everything." So like that's sort of mm-hmm. his lesson, you know? And the other most famous one is Lucia herself when she is begging to be set free after being kidnapped.
Yeah.
And that God will forgive many things for an act of mercy. You know, so you may be the nameless one, you may be basically the devil incarnate, but if you just do this one thing, God will forgive you. So the novel, it's like you do have all the characters are in these dynamics of like forgiveness and whatever the opposite of that is, mm-hmm. keeping grudges, and of mercy or mercilessness, and of which is related to like how free you are, like. To be merciful, that is an act of my freedom, but it's also choosing not to do something sometimes. And it also relies on the other person's being ready to receive forgiveness somehow. And we see all these different kinds of souls put into this pressure with different preparations or lack of preparation, with, I mean, Lucia so beautifully innocent, or the nameless one so deeply guilty. Cristoforo kind of also deeply guilty, but then has this sort of heroic innocence in his own way, or whatever we would call it. It's a really cool, I think it's, yeah, just to watch the characters go through it and see what shows up. And Abundio maybe is like the absolute minimum. Like, yeah. I don't quite despise him, but I do a little bit, you know, it's right at the border. Mm-hmm. It's, or maybe it's like his crimes are all crimes of neglect. He hasn't done anything wrong. He just has done nothing good.
Well, what I wrote down next to him is lukewarm.
Yeah.
Lukewarm, and that's what gets spit out of God's mouth, and you can really see it. You're like, oh, yeah, you're not doing anything one way or the other. Come on, do something. Well, and I was thinking, I liked what you were saying about just now about all these people and taking action or not taking action, forgiving, you can forgive someone, they may or may not accept it, but you have to take that action. And then as Padre Cristoforo said, you just go on and don't worry about it, right?
Right.
Just let it go. And because that goes along with advice that he gave to Lucia, which I'm just now thinking is also caught up in your own free will, how you alone can control, you can only control your own actions, mm-hmm. and you can't control other people. And so when Don Abundio is continually going, it's their fault. Well, it's also your fault.
Yeah.
Are you holding on to it? Are you not doing something? Are you doing something? So when she's saying, oh, but I made this vow to the Virgin Mary, I'd remain chaste for my whole life. And so I can't get married. And so she says, but it was a vow to our Lord, to the Blessed Virgin. And he says, the Lord, my daughter, appreciates sacrifices, offerings, when they affect us alone, when we make them from the heart of our own free will. But you cannot offer up the free will of another to whom you were already bound.
Yeah.
And I marked that because I just thought, that's it. You can't make promises that affect someone else in this way that's integral Yeah. And all these things that these people are accusing other people of or wanting to get revenge of, that's essentially doing that very thing.
Yeah, I think that is one of the key moments. I think also for whether you like the novel or not, is what do you make of Lucia's, I mean, a lot of the energy of the latter part comes from that vow she makes, which seems so pure and powerful. And then whether we look at Cristoforo's, I mean, he absolves her of the vow using that reasoning, right? Which it's like, well, right or wrong, you know, which way, what do we make of that? It strikes me as such a like really what you were saying. I mean, it really teaches something important about the nature of our commitments and our intentions. Mm-hmm. That notion that, yeah, you did make that vow, but you couldn't, you think you did, but you made a vow using things that aren't yours to use. Like because you already also made a vow to Lorenzo that you would marry him.
I love too is that she offered up what was most precious to her in her life.
Yeah.
She offered that to the Virgin. So in her ignorance, it was a sincere vow that God honored, but then the priest had to come in and go, yeah, and the Virgin did it, or the Virgin prayed for you, or whatever. Anyway, you got saved, but.
But now you can find something. Yeah, right, right.
Mm-hmm. There's a faulty premise.
Yeah, it is. It is very beautiful. And it, in its own way, that's like the transformation that even Lucia has to go through. She's sort of called maybe there to a deep, like a. She's obviously such a deeply religious, like really deep, you know, like her deepest instincts in many ways are formed in innocence and resignation to suffering unjustly and faith. So like
obedience,
right.
Obedient, yeah.
But she's, you know, not exactly timid, you wouldn't say. I mean, she's resistant and almost stubborn, like in a holy way. Mm. But, she also has to learn that it's not just about her prayer there. It's like that was part of a larger story. It's an interesting challenge for her. Of course, she's ready to accept it because it happens to be she's being given back exactly what she wanted.
Well, if you say so. Yeah. All right.
Part of me, she was even against the plan to get around the marriage.
Yeah.
You know, she was arguing with Renzo saying this is not the right way to do this.
Yeah.
I loved the fact that early in the book, I was texting Scott going, or I think it was you going, oh my gosh, this book this early is using Catholic doctrine correctly for the wrong, in the wrong way for the humor. But I was like, but this is true.
Yeah. Isn't that great?
Yeah. I loved it. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I love that. Yes. That's a great scene too. I mean, just
it's so
they're
funny.
Trying to convince her, like we've got it all planned out. We just got to ambush the priest.
And get her vows in front of him while he's standing there and distract the housekeeper so she doesn't get in there and get in the way.
Yeah.
And of course, he and the priest, of course, I mean, they all believe this is accurate and possible, right? And then when the priest recognizes it and he kind of throws the table over or whatever, like, he kind of commits like an act of violence. But he does it right before. So Lucia is just about to say, Renzo has already said that that's his wife, and Lucia is about to say that Renzo is her husband, and the priest, by his own cowardly instincts, stops her. I thought there's one of those moments where a man does something for a bad reason, but he has a good effect. He prevents Lucia from going against her conscience and doing that.
Yeah, right.
That's so good.
It's an interesting moment because you see, it's a kind of a, it's like they believe the sacraments so almost too much, you know, right? Then you see the providence at play.
Well, that's it. Providence is such a large part of the book and not in a, you know, just hitting you over the head with it. Although there's a few times where things very obviously happen, but they're beautifully done.
Yeah.
So it doesn't matter. But a lot of the times you see things that happened earlier in the book, they come back around in a way where you see how they had a bigger effect than anyone expected.
Yeah.
I love the night that they're, to me, like the most exciting part of the plot, really. I mean, in terms of action, I guess, like, when they're going to ambush the priest happens to be the same night that the guys are coming to take her. And then like, so the bell tower, there's like three or four different things happening all at once. And conveniently it means that nobody gets hurt and the bells are ringing. And so the guys run. And I thought that's one of those, it's like Providence, but it's also just the novelist, you know,
being.
I was wondering what those scenes would be like, at least to listen to, if they're well read, because some of them are so funny.
Oh yeah.
The author keeps addressing the audience too. And earlier you were saying, you know, he's going to take this aside and go through a character or whatever. He even says, I think once or twice, this may not be worth your time.
Yeah.
But if I'm going like to do this, if you don't want this, then move on. You know, I thought that was funny.
I love that. I mean, one of the things I love in a novel is when it does that kind of thing. That's why, to me, when I first picked up this novel, I was charmed right away because I love things that begin this way, where I found this old manuscript. And then occasionally he'll appeal to, he's like, well, our author says he doesn't know why this character did that. Or our author uses this ridiculous simile. So although I think it's too much, I'll give it to you anyway. It's a fun way of you simultaneously make the work seem very serious, but then you also distance yourself from it and make it seem something light.
Yeah.
And so he's
it's authentic, in that way. It's like, I don't know, it's just in the book. Well, and I like, because the things you're mentioning are kind of, you know, there, it's that light way of doing it, as you and Scott were saying, but he also will make little comments that I marked a bunch of them where I was just like, he's just funny. It says, anyone who wonders how Padre Cristoforo was able to arrange for all of this transportation by land and by water and so quickly, obviously doesn't know the power of a Capuchin monk reputed to be a saint.
Yeah.
I mean, that's so action-y. They're escaping, they're getting on the boat, they're separating, they're gonna, you know, all the things. And he's like, well, you know, it's a great way of getting around all the details that he's been including for everything else. He's like, who knows how it happened? He asked, they did it.
Yeah, it's friar magic.
Yeah.
I do feel that to me is part of the very Italian feeling of the novel, is that there's a sense of kind of good humor amid the clash and of the world, you know, like the kind of imperturbable friar. but it's a good humor that is founded in the characters in a real deep faith in God's providence. In many ways, a kind of simple book. I mean, it literally preachy at times, but it really, I think, demands a lot of soul searching on the part of the reader too. And what is it? You know, it even ends with, here's the moral of the story.
might not agree with me.
Yeah. Yeah. I like, trouble often comes calling when it's been invited in. Not even the most cautious and innocent behavior can keep it away. And when trouble does come calling rightly or wrongly, faith in God softens the blow and turns it to a better purpose, right? Mm-hmm. In Italian, the translator just says it's the moral of the story, which, of course, the way we say it in English. In Italian, it's il sugo, which is like the pasta sauce.
I was just going to say, is that sauce? That's really awesome. Funny.
So that's the way of saying the gist of the story, right? The core of it. It's the when you boil it down, this is what you get. Yeah. The sugo.
It coats everything.
Yeah. Is this
that's
sense.
Awesome.
Yeah, it's really
because cool. It is, you know, I guess the other big theme in it is the problem of evil. Yeah. And that is what he's talking about there. You know, both, you know, there's human evil, you know, there's institutional, and there's also the natural calamity.
Yeah.
These characters are dealing with all of that stuff.
Yeah. And it shouldn't be a surprise to us when these things come at us. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the errors of Abbondio, is when trouble comes his way, he acts like it's not fair.
Right.
When he's, you know, the cardinal tells him, well, you took orders because you wanted to face this trouble. Like you knew there was trouble.
Right.
You shouldn't
crying. You could just see him going, I don't think that's why I took orders.
Yeah.
No. Yeah. Well, and that's our, but in that case, oh, now I'm really humbled for all the things I've said about Abundio, because isn't that all of us?
Right.
None of us expect anything bad to happen. We all go, well, but how did this happen? For all those things, the government gets your tax return wrong, but whatever, or up to the real big life stuff. Yeah. And you just go, hey, that's not fair. And you get mad. And
yeah, I do feel that. I mean, it's hard to preach resignation in an exciting way, you know. we need to be resigned to the trouble of the world and respond to it with what the cardinal calls intrepid love, right? And forgiveness. It's hard to make that exciting as a message, and that's one of the things I like in the novel, is it actually makes this, because the characters, I mean, the cardinal has a deep grasp of it. Even Cristoforo is working at it, I think, when we first encounter him, because he still has his cranky temperament. But so, like, the novelist doesn't make that lesson so easy, but it is consistent, and it makes it interesting. I mean, that there's a letter of Manzoni's about, like, what, how to make literature, that's often quoted. He says it should have as its scope, its goal is to actually be useful, utile, something, it should change the way you act, right? And to do that, the subject should be the truth. And the means should be being interesting. You should actually write something interesting.
Amen.
Yeah.
And that's the only way.
That's what we're all about. Yeah, I love it.
That's the whole thing. Yeah, that's exactly it.
Yeah. So that's why it's fun, because the first time I read the novel, I read it very slowly over a long period, maybe months, you know. And then this, more recently, I read it over a series of just a few days and really absorbed in it. And then I've read a lot of snippets of it in Italian. But getting to actually face it all in a short, you know, read it like all day for a few days, it's an overwhelming kind of challenge to reread, you know, your own life and in light of these characters. I mean, to me, even Don Abbondio, I've been thinking of him all the time now, just in my own life. And when the demands of work come, you know, what is it? What is the response? What is the best way to frame my response to the challenges?
Well, so, you know, I'm not a priest, but I feel the same way, especially after this conversation about, you know, just me and my job. And I remember when I first started the job I currently have, which is in administration of a technical college, I always thought that I was doing a good job if nothing was going on. I mean, there were no problems, right? And if a problem hit, it would cause anxiety. But the thing is, problems always hit. Right. And you've got to be bold in facing those, you know, and stepping forward into them rather than trying to avoid.
Yeah. Like my job is actually to be in the problem.
Exactly right. Exactly right. And this is like a perfect illustration.
Office hours as a professor, you know, so I've got a block of time that I've set for sort of walk-in meetings, no appointment necessary. Part of me always wishes nobody would come so I can actually catch up on work.
Right, right.
I sit there for 2 hours with my door open and wait to be interrupted. Mm-hmm. But then I have to remind myself, like, well, no, like, the point of my job is, in fact, to be available right now for whoever walks in. Mm-hmm. I am doing my work right now. Yeah. I'm not missing a chance to do something. I find that, in life, takes constant correction in this. Sort of daily. But the novel helps with that. I mean, it's a captivating set of images, even if it is kind of, I mean, to me, it's like closest to like the Three Musketeers, you know, like we're a different world, but it's easy to enjoy and to use somehow to inspire, my own better efforts, you know?
Yeah. Well, I love that.
I had an interesting experience reading this book because coincidentally, I had picked up a book about Teresa of Avila's life.
Mm.
So Teresa of Avila, God Alone Suffices, by Jean-Jacques Antier, A-N-T-I-E-R. And it's a big book about her life, and it talks about the context of the times and everything, but it always keeps the focus on her and what she was doing and thinking and what she was going through. And that provided the perfect kind of like mindset that when I would pick up The Betrothed between times, I'd kind of get mixed up over what I was reading for a little while sometimes, because she was living in the same kind of world, very chaotic, primitive about the way she wanted to live anyway. And fighting people who kept going, oh, no, that's not reasonable. You're wanting to do this. Or people who are just, you know, like, oh, no, we will have none of this. How dare you sacrifice anything? And it just fit in a lot with this book. So,
yeah, that sounds about right. That. I would think of one saint. That would, Saint Teresa of Avila would be one that in my mind does fit right into the style of the Betrothed too, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, and especially when I was reading about the nun, I was just reading it going, oh, yeah. I mean, the author's making it clear. I mean, he doubles down on it toward the end of the part you talked about, Father Stephen, about she was living like this with all this resentment and everything, but here were all these people around her that were great examples of how to live with these troubles.
Yeah.
And be loving and kind, and they still liked her anyway.
Yeah.
You know, and then you'd go and read this book, and there were those kind of situations there in the similar kind of life. It was really a very deep experience for everything I was reading at the moment. It was great.
Mm.
Yeah. That's great. That's great.
I mean, I liked it well enough, but now that we've, of course, as you know, dug into things, I'm like, oh, I see more how they're connected, more of what the author was kind of doing with it. I'll definitely be reading it again sometime.
Yeah, I know that there are several Italian film versions of it, and I haven't ever watched any of them. So I'm tempted now. I don't know if any have, they might exist in subtitles or something like that, but I'm curious now to spend more time seeing how they try to portray some of these characters.
Yeah, me too.
Find a me good too. One, tell
and
us.
As I was poking around, I saw that there's a BBC radio version of it.
Oh, yeah?
I'm curious about that, but BBC radio keeps doing things like... let's modernize iRobot. They're like, oh, so it's eye rolling. Yeah. It's not like,
yeah, thank you.
Yeah. So I don't know if that's the case here, but I'm curious.
Mm.
Yeah. But thank you, Father Stephen, for bringing us this book. This is one I probably wouldn't have come across. I had heard of it, but I don't know if I'd have taken the time to delve into this, and I appreciate it.
Well, I'm glad you did. Yeah.
Yeah. I did enjoy it. Yep.
I also really liked what you said about it's so reflective in so many ways of just the Italian spirit or the Italian people. Probably never going to be able to get over to Italy, or if I do, I can't experience it the way you did. But I liked that everybody in this book was kind of big. They were all kind of, I mean, I'm not trying to stereotype, but they were just, they were warm-hearted, they were very warm-hearted. But they were practical, they were so practical. Yeah. They were just... all in.
It's like an opera all the time. In that way, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, kind of like
yeah. It. Often the book, the novel here is still, this is more like an opera than a novel.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And not quite that bad, but you know, you felt like they were being genuine and authentic, and unless they were trying not to be, in which case they were doing that all the way.
So. Yeah, there's a kind of openness of character that I think is really fits all of them and is very different from the kind of English character that informs also then our literary tradition.
Hmm.
Yeah, not Jane Eyre, that's for sure.
That's great.
Which I love.
But Gothic all the same. Gothic all the same.
Gothic all the same, but very different personalities.
Yeah, right. Exactly. Who's going to reform that bad boy?
Yeah.
Jane's going to do it. And God.
I love that. That's
but
true.
Here it takes a whole country.
Very much. All right. Well, thank you again.
Thank you.
So, next up for us is a science fiction novel. Called All Flesh is Grass by Clifford D. Simak. And I think that's from, is that from a psalm, All Flesh is Grass?
Yeah, I think it's quoted at the very beginning of the book.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah, but it's a terrific book. I really like it anyway, so hopefully, Julie, you will. So.
Oh, man, I partway into it, and I had to put it down because I had other things to do, and I couldn't just sit there and read it, but I picked it up again. It's
fun.
So... surprising.
Yeah.
But it was written when it was, and it's that Clifford Simak good.
Yeah.
Just like the Way Station, you know?
Yeah, right.
You just sink into it.
Good.
Yeah.
Yeah. Love it. Looking forward to talking about it.
Me too.
All right.
Maybe I'll read it and listen to your podcast.
Please do. Please do.
Excellent.
Yeah. Well, so thanks again, Father Stephen. Much appreciated.
Thank you so much.
Thank you all for having me.
And thank you all for listening. And we'll catch you in a couple of weeks.
Yeah. Talk to you again soon.
Okay. Bye-bye. Bye. Thank you.